Hello and welcome to Brain Injury Bites, where we provide help and advice for people after a brain injury. Hi, I'm Ashwani and I'm a trustee at Headway Warrington. I'm also a senior associate solicitor focusing on catastrophic injury, including brain injury.
My name's Brooke and I've lived with a traumatic brain injury since 2007.
Brooke and I are joined today by Sian Riley from Red Pepper Nutrition. We're delighted to have you with us, Sian. Sian is a dietitian, but I'm going to hand over to you to tell us more about who you are and what you do.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me here today. Yes, my name's Sian Riley and I'm a dietitian. I specialise in rehabilitation. So mostly brain injury, but also see people in rehabilitation after spinal cord injury and orthopaedic injury.
Obviously, we're here to talk about brain injury rehabilitation. So we'll be talking to you today about your role in rehabilitating people with brain injury and how dietetics is an important part of that. But perhaps, again, you can tell us, what kind of input do you have with people who've suffered a traumatic brain injury? And at what point do you get involved?
Good question. So, I mean, it's a bit corny, but I kind of feel that nutrition is the foundation of rehabilitation. And that's because after a trauma, your body's doing a huge amount of healing. Mm-hmm. And in that healing process, it's using up a lot of nutrition because it's the building blocks to that healing process. Quite often, a lot of people will start their rehabilitation journey in a state of malnutrition, which means that they're not going to reach their rehabilitation potential, but also their health is going to be compromised in that. So in terms of when I get involved, I usually get involved further on down the rehabilitation journey, but I would love to get involved earlier because I think if we can address nutrition in the earliest stages of rehabilitation, and that's going to be really, really beneficial.
I guess it's quite difficult, isn't it, when there are so many other clinicians involved, so many other therapeutic interventions, that perhaps nutrition does take a little bit of a backseat.
Yes, unfortunately, it does seem to not be prioritised as much. And obviously, in the hospital setting, it does hopefully tend to be prioritised more, the kind of basics of nutrition and sleep as well. But yeah, it tends to be only really addressed when there's an issue and when there's a visible issue. But we obviously know that if somebody's not healing optimally, then there'll be a lot going on in the body that's not working as it should.
I was going to say about the hospital, you say, do you think it's good, the nutrition in hospital?
I think it could always be better, yeah. Definitely. I think it's, again, it's not prioritised as much as it should be in hospital. I think particularly when somebody's able to eat their own food, so yeah, the kind of hospital catering, I don't think it's prioritised financially in a hospital setting. I think the kind of the situation in a hospital where people are eating is not great for a meal environment. You know, you've got the sights and sounds and smells of a busy ward, yeah, and you're expected to have your meal there.
In your bed, probably.
In your bed, so you're not in the right posture position. Yeah. To be eaten, and of course the catering staff in the hospital having to provide meals for quite a number of people on quite measly budgets a lot, yeah, of the time. So they're in a really difficult situation. Usually in the very early stages of rehabilitation, if somebody's not able to eat and drink, they might have like nasogastric tubes, and there the kind of the nutrition from the hospital dietitians will be more of a priority. And you know, the hospital dietitians and the medics are very aware of the increased need for nutrition in that situation.
I was going to say the nutrition available in Salford Royal to buy in, like, you know, as an outpatient in the cafe setting now is a lot better than when I was in there. I mean, yeah, that was quite a long time ago. It was 15 years ago, but it seems there's a lot more choice now. I don't know what it's like as a patient, but I assume it's improved quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is that. It's the choice of food, isn't it?
Yeah.
And going to a cafe and having that, and it's we just need to be able to recreate that in the hospital environment.
You said about your posture, what's the best position to eat food in?
Well, yeah, I suppose that speech and language therapists might have some opinions on that, but I think kind of sat upright in a chair. When you're in a bed, you tend to be lying back a bit, so you've not got that kind of same gravity for your swallow.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
So yeah, it's just making sure you're not slumped in a bed, but also to be changing positions and, you know, kind of getting out of the bed if you're able to eat your food is obviously much more pleasurable.
Yeah, of course.
Eating experience.
Yeah, and I suppose in hospital, you know, if you're spending all your time in bed or most of your time in bed and just, you know, eating becomes functional rather than pleasurable. And so then there's less focus on the value of it in a way. It's just something that needs to be fueling the body, and that's it.
Yeah, definitely. And this kind of social element of eating is just really important. Whereas if you're sat in your bed eating your meal, and everybody's sat in their bed, they're not eating together. They're eating in the same position. So
thinking specifically about brain injury then, I think we've talked about in previous episodes the some of the physiological impacts of brain injury, and that can have an impact on someone's sense of smell and someone's sense of taste. So perhaps you can talk us through the five senses and just what happens when the sorts of things you've seen in your role of what happens when somebody has a brain injury, how that impacts on their taste and smell in particular.
Yeah, so we see quite often after a brain injury, someone might lose their sense of smell, which has a massive impact on their appetite, on their nutrition, but also on how they're feeling, their mental health, their feelings of isolation. Mm. So when we talk about smell loss, we talk about anosmia and parosmia. So anosmia is where we lose sense of smell. And that can quite often happen in brain injury because the neurons from our brain are going into our nasal cavity and they can sometimes be sheared off after a brain injury and they can regrow.
Okay.
And sometimes when they regrow, like regeneration, they can regrow and form wrong connections.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Is that why you like different foods afterwards?
Can be. It can also, when the neurons form wrongly, they can produce different smells to what you're expecting. So that causes parosmia. And that's when you smell things that aren't there or you're smelling different things from a strong sense of smell.
Okay. So is it sort of like something might suddenly smell like rubber, which isn't, but
It's usually a really unpleasant smell. So it might be, I've heard people say things smell like burning rubber, tar, burning, which actually it is a positive, as in those neurons are reforming.
Yes.
So it's more likely that your sense of smell will improve over time when that happens, but it's obviously really distressing.
Of course.
And it can put people off. Can put people off eating if your meal's coming towards you and it's smelling to you of burnt tar, then that can be really alarming. Mm-hmm. But it might put people off going to restaurants, going to cafes, because again they're having that experience.
And I suppose there's a wider impact to that, both in terms of the social side of it, you know, you lose out on those social experiences because it becomes potentially unbearable, but also from a nutritional point of view, if things smell different to how they should smell, or, you know, then someone might sort of stop eating and that can have other negative impacts.
Yeah, I mean, smell, I mean, it's one of our five senses. So when somebody's down a sense, that's massive and has a huge impact. But our sense of smell is there to stimulate our appetite. So when we're smelling food as it's cooking, it's preparing our body for that food coming.
Yes.
And we're forming a judgment of that food. So we're forming a judgment that it smells good. We want to eat it. It's safe. And that gets our saliva going.
Yeah.
Our saliva's going just talking about it. And it also gets our gastric juices going. So we're kind of preparing our body for what's coming.
Yeah.
If you don't have that smell, you're not preparing yourself, so you're almost, the food going into your mouth is your first experience of that food, so you're not going to have the same appetite for it.
Do you still get hungry if you can't smell?
I think you will still get hungry if your body needs food, but I don't think you're going to have that same desire for food that you do before. So quite often some of my clients will talk about just not wanting food, getting no enjoyment from food, not having the appetite anymore, which can have a huge impact nutritionally, because I was talking before about how a lot of people will start their rehabilitation journey in a state of malnutrition. Yeah. And then to, you know, to almost needing to catch up on your nutrition, and you've got these additional issues that are preventing you from eating. Mm. One of the you know, reasons I love being a dietitian is because I love food. Yeah. And when people aren't enjoying food, I just find that really sad.
Yeah.
Because it should be a huge enjoyment.
It's such an intrinsic part of the human experience. It's what binds people, families, cultures, everything. It's, you know, everyone has food in common in a way. And it's such a big, talking about, it's a big part of how we socialize. And coming back to what you were saying before, if people then don't feel that they want to, because they don't want to go to restaurants or whatever, because it's off-putting, that the smell of food just becomes off-putting, then psychologically that could be quite detrimental, because you're missing out on those social occasions with friends, with family, etc.
Definitely.
And then
I think
it can become quite isolating.
Yeah, massive isolation at a time in their life when, you know, having community around you is so important.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a charity called Fifth Sense that look at smell loss after brain injury. The founder of Fifth Sense, Duncan Boak, had a head injury himself and lost his sense of smell, so kind of set up the charity to support those in similar situation. And they did some research looking at the effects of smell loss after head injury. You know, there was a lot of talk about feeling socially isolated, depression, a dulling of senses, that they just felt that they were experiencing life at a lower sensation, I suppose, that they didn't have the same highs, the same lows as before they lost their smell. And yeah, that kind of extra anxiety of going out and being in a social situation where perhaps they couldn't handle the smells that were coming, or had less enjoyment of the food and the situation, was really quite apparent.
Well, we'll definitely put a link to a charity there in our show notes.
Yeah, that'd be great.
And anyone that is suffering with that, please do check that out. I wanted to come back to something that you mentioned about, you know, the neurons shearing and potentially malforming, which is what causes this change. Is it possible for that to almost recalibrate? Can somebody regain a proper sense of smell after those neurons have kind of mismatched?
Yeah, so there is some research to show that neurons can regenerate and they can reform, which is really encouraging. I'd quite often do something like smell training with clients.
Okay.
So again, on the Fifth Sense website, you can see examples of how to do smell training. And you can also buy some little smell training pots from a charity called Absence as well. And the idea of smell training is that you're encouraging those neuron connections. So you have kind of five pots of smells. So it might be things like flowery petals. Yeah, have you seen these?
I've heard of it. I've not done it myself. So that's something I never really had a problem with, the smell. But
right. So you have these pots of, so it might be things like rose petals, eucalyptus, it's that Holbus oil type smell. And you would kind of smell them as training, if you like.
Yeah.
And the idea is that you rate your smell of them at the start. And I think you're supposed to do it weekly or even daily to kind of get those neuro pathways back formed. It's quite, you know, they call it training. And it's really useful, I think, one, because it identifies where your smell loss is at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So quite often we talk about, or clients will talk about not having any smell.
Mm.
And actually when you do smell training with them, they will have something. So I think that's kind of really encouraging when they can identify something there. And the smell bit of our brain is very closely linked to memory. So sometimes even talking about a memory associated to a smell can just help those neuropathways reform. So for instance, with the eucalyptus one, I've had a client who it reminded her of her grandmother's hankies, the smell of Olbus oil. So she would think about that memory while smelling it, and it's kind of getting all those pathways reformed if we can. But also I find smell training is really useful to do it with family and friends, because if you're smelling things and you're discussing that smell and or discussing the lack of smell, I think that's really something tangible that family can understand.
Yeah, because quite
often when someone's lost their sense of smell, it's just dismissed and not talked about, and the impact's not talked about. So to have that experience with family where you say, oh, really? You can't smell that? Gosh, it's so strong. You know, at least the kind of understanding where that person's come from.
It's interesting what you're saying there about a person who, for them, that smell reminded them of their grandma's hanky.
Yeah.
Because obviously when we're dealing with a brain injured cohort, you've got also memory issues. So, and smell is quite often linked with memory. You know, you smell something, it takes you back to a particular time, a particular point, person, whatever. So I wonder whether that additional complication, the sort of impact on memory.
It kind of dampens the memory, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because they're not making those links again to past events.
Yeah.
And I think it dampens the emotion. So, you know, we don't think of smell being an emotional or to produce an emotional response in us, but actually that smell of Olbers oil on your grandma's hankies is a very emotional response, isn't it? Emotional memory.
So
I think smell training is definitely worth doing, and it's something that I very much recommend to a lot of my clients who've lost their smell.
And do you find by and large that people do report more positive outcomes?
Yeah, I mean, I think the science, the research behind improvements after in the smell after brain injury isn't as positive as perhaps improvements in smell after say, a viral infection. So something like, you know, a lot of people lost their sense of smell after COVID in the first wave. If you've lost your sense of smell from a viral infection, there's better research to say that that'll come back.
Okay.
With brain injury, it's less likely to, but I still think it's worth trying, because even a tiny improvement could make a massive difference for somebody's quality of life. And again, if you've got that parosmia where your neurons are reforming incorrectly, that is a positive sign that the neurons are reforming. They've just got to find the right place. Yeah.
Just moving to taste then, because, you know, we talked about the loss of smell, but there's also the loss of taste. And talk to us about the impact of that on people who are recovering from brain injury.
Yeah, so we've talked quite a bit about the kind of like the smell of food kind of stimulating our appetite. But once it's in your mouth, the smell is also really important. So when we talk about the taste of food, actually quite often what we're talking about really is the flavour of food.
Mm.
And the flavour of food is made up from the smell, but it's also made up from our taste buds on our tongue.
Mm-hmm.
And actually our taste buds on our tongue, we've only got five basic tastes. And those basic tastes are sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami. And when we talk about losing our sense of taste, actually we've still got our sense of taste, but we've lost our sense of smell. So the flavour of food is very different. So it tastes different, but it's actually the flavour.
Yeah. I suppose it's a bit like when you have a cold or something and you just can't taste food the same way.
Yeah, definitely. And if you want to kind of understand how smell affects taste, I've done like a jelly bean experiment in the past. So basically, it's very simple. You eat jelly beans, it's great. But you just pinch your nose, close your eyes so you can't see the colour of the jelly beans, and just eat them and see if you can guess the flavour. And it's really interesting because things like sour and bitter, you can usually taste. So if you're having a lemon flavoured jelly bean, you'll usually be able to identify that it's lemon.
Okay.
I had a coffee flavoured jelly bean and all I could taste was the sweetness.
Oh, interesting.
And then I let go of my nose and the overwhelming coffee-ness came. So you can kind of see that for somebody without their sense of smell, every jelly bean will taste the same, very sweet, perhaps a little bit sour, but mostly just very sweet. They're not getting those individual flavours coming through.
Mm.
So for somebody eating a meal, they might be tasting the salt, they might be tasting the sugar, you know, maybe bitter and sour, which we can use to our advantage. But generally, the food will taste a lot blander than it did before their accident. Yeah. So I think you were mentioning, Brooke, about food tasting different after your accident.
Yeah, it did, but I don't think it lasted that long. What's umami?
Oh, yeah. So.
A bit like your sort of, it's that, the only way I can describe it is kind of that, kind of like a soy saucy kind of, I think is miso part of the umami food group, like if you've ever had like miso soup, so it's something that just kind of makes you go I'm just gonna keep doing that into the mic.
So I think it's Japanese for delicious. It's I describe it as it's quite a meaty taste. It's a very delicious taste, so it's got a really nice feel, if you like, in your mouth and quite satisfying. So things like soya sauce, even tomato, ketchup, actually.
Barbecue sauce, I think, is a very umami flavour.
Yeah, fish sauce, Worcestershire sauce, which I can never say.
Fish sauce, fish sauce is just disgusting.
It is, but it kind of needs to be, if it's used right, it's kind of bringing out that umami. Things like your meats, fish, eggs, and their mushrooms is also really high in umami. Okay. So I think mushrooms is the one that I can recognize more because I think something like mushrooms taste very meaty. But they're just a vegetable. They're just mushrooms. Yeah. But you can have something like mushroom soup and it'll taste very kind of satisfying.
I think it's
and
probably
meaty.
Also why it's used in a lot of vegan alternatives to meat.
To kind of, definitely. I think the other really interesting thing about umami, so our taste buds are there to get nutrition in. It wants you to, your tongue wants you to enjoy the food, so you're getting that nutrition in. And umami foods tend to be very high in glutamate and amino acid, which make up protein. So it's your body trying to get that nutritious protein foods in. So when we've lost our sense of smell, we really need to be using our basic tastes as much as possible to make food more interesting and to get that taste from it as much as possible. So using umami rich foods is a really good way of getting that in.
So everybody obviously has a different brain, don't they? Is that why people like different foods, because of the different structures in the brain?
I think so. I think all our brains are very unique, aren't they? And, we don't know how other people taste food.
You have a Marmite brain or a non-Marmite
brain. I suppose there's all sorts of factors in there. It's like there's a bit of a nature-nurture thing there as well. You know, if you're brought up in a particular cultural environment and your food, sort of your staple foods are this, then, you know, it's why certain people always go for spicy or not, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, our smell and our taste is there to prevent us eating foods that are dangerous to us. So if we've been brought up on, say, spicy foods, you know, lots of herbs and spices, we'll have been brought up knowing that those foods are safe and that they tend to be the foods we'll go for, really. Mm-hmm. And that can be quite alarming for someone after the loss of smell, because they don't know what foods are safe anymore, and it can kind of increase their anxiety.
Well, that actually brings me nicely to risk factors after brain injury and the impact on smell and taste. So you've mentioned that, not knowing whether something's safe or not, but I suppose there's some very basic safety issues around a lack of smell and lack of taste. Do you want to sort of explain some of those to our audience?
So I think, you know, how many times do you sniff a bottle of milk before you put it in your cup of tea? So things like that are really important, that we need to know if we use smell to decide if the food's gone off. Quite often, if you don't have that, then you're relying on things like your use-by dates and your sell-by dates, which recently a lot of the big supermarkets have actually taken the use-by dates and sell-by dates off their products to reduce food waste. So completely understand their reasoning for it, but for somebody after a brain injury and after losing the sense of smell, that can be really impactful from a safety point of view. And also, well, even with a use-by date and a sell-by date, you don't know how that food's been stored. So, you know, your milk could have been left out on the side. So if you're just following a use-by date, it's not always appropriate. So, from a food safety point of view, you're a sense down. So you can only really see if the food looks off rather than smelling it. And there's also kind of issues from kind of fire point of view, gas leaks, burning food. Yeah, there are a lot of kind of safety risks there as well.
Mm.
There's also, you know, rather than safety risk, there's a risk to health as well, because we've still got the basic tastes, and we talked about sweet and salty being those basic tastes. Quite often what we can do is end up relying on those tastes more. So if a food tastes salty, it doesn't taste bland, and you can taste that.
Mm.
They might add more salt to your food after a brain injury, which will have then impacts on things like cardiovascular disease,
blood pressure,
and also, you know, a very common one is to add more sugar to your food.
And
I completely understand why, because you want to eat a food and you want it to taste exactly the same as it did before. So if you find a sweet food that you can taste and it tastes familiar to you, you're going to go for that.
Mm.
So it might be that somebody, you know, adds more sugar to their tea because actually it tastes like they remember it. But it can obviously cause,
well, it's impacting on the calorific input and
other
issues around
Thank you for listening to part one. We hope you can join us for part two.
Please don't forget to follow, subscribe, and share our content. If you do have any suggestions for topics that you'd like us to cover, why not drop us a line at hi@braininjurybites.co.uk.